Sorry, Your Honor, my volume was off. That's why I couldn't hear anything.
And what I said was, whenever you're ready.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor, for the opportunity to organize my thoughts. As I indicated, I will be relying mostly on my written submissions, but I will take an opportunity to reply to what Mr. Potter has said in his oral submissions by making reference to my written factum. So the first point that I'd like to respond to are the inconsistencies in the complainant's testimony that Mr. Potter refers to. The first inconsistency that he pointed to was the fact that she testified that she liked to take some COVID precautions, but he was able to find some photos from her Twitter feed that kind of contradicted that assertion that she had made. And in my submission, the trial judge precisely spoke to this issue in his reasons for judgment, and that comes from the trial transcript first, page 3, and it's about halfway through the page. The trial judge writes, "Mr. Potter argues that Ms. Vandelbelt's evidence is not credible or reliable. He points to, among other factors, a statement that she gave to the officer on application for remote testimony, saying she did not want to interact with persons who were unmasked or unvaccinated, which he says was contradicted by both photographic evidence and her own admission. I accept there is some contradiction between her prior testimony and the facts. Overall, Ms. Vandelbelt has largely explained the statements, saying any contradiction is misspeaking in what was intended, and that she was she intended to have said she did not interact with persons unless they were unmasked or unvaccinated, not necessarily both." And then the trial judge continues and eventually says that he accepts Ms. Vandelbelt's explanation for this inconsistency, and that he notes that he's entitled to reject some or all of the witness's evidence, and in this case he found that the contradiction was immaterial to the evidence she had given in respect to the actual offense before the court. So in my respectful submission, this is exactly an inconsistency that what the trial judge was alive to. It was made at the time of the trial. He precisely responded to it, and as His Honor noted, he was entitled to accept some or none or all of the witness's testimony, and he found that this inconsistency was peripheral to the matter, and thereby accepted her testimony. The trial judge was entitled to do this, and that assessment is a factual finding that is entitled to deference. Another inconsistency that Mr. Potter points to is the calculation of time, of how long Ms. Vandelbelt was confined for. And I address this issue at paragraph 42 of my factum. And there, I highlight how initially Ms. Vandelbelt testified in chief that she thought she was confined for about a 10 to 15 minute period of time. And then in cross-examination by counsel, it was suggested to her that perhaps the time was closer to 7 or 9 minutes instead of 10 to 15. And she agrees that time assessment was possible. Later during the Crown submissions, the Crown argued that she was confined for approximately a 10-minute period, and Justice Boxall interjected to say that she had gone down to about 7 or maybe 8 minutes. So in my submission, this demonstrates that Justice Boxall was alive to the evidence that he heard about the time submissions. There was an evidentiary basis for him to find that she was confined for excess of 5 minutes based on her own testimony. And it demonstrates that he was attuned to this issue for the trial. The fact that she initially said 10 to 15 minutes in her examination in chief and went down to 7 or 9 minutes in cross-examination, and my submission, is not perjury. It's simply an inconsistency. It's the reason why we have cross-examination and trials generally, just to test that evidence. And it demonstrates that her evidence, even through cross-examination, she still maintained her position that it was in excess of 5 minutes. again, I disagree with Mr. Potter's assertion that it's either perjury or not. I would submit that inconsistencies are a well-recognized concept in criminal law. Witnesses aren't expected to have perfect memories, and this is why they are challenged by cross-examination. And as the trial judge noted, he was allowed to assess that Potter has little evidence, or little weight as he wanted to after hearing her evidence. So, all in all, my submission is that all of the inconsistencies that Mr. Potter highlights were addressed throughout the trial. The ones that were not is likely because they were not made in submission, so the trial judge may not have addressed them head on, but the trial judge did note in his reasons that that Mr. Potter was disputing Ms. Vanderbilt's evidence as not credible or reliable generally. He was not required to go through every single factor in his assessment. So in summary on that point, these are factual findings that are entitled to deference. And my position is that this is not a basis to allow the appeal.
What does the Crown say about Mr. Potter's submission that Ms. Vandenbelt's evidence was to the effect that she'd only been confined for 3 to 3.5 minutes? I think that was what he was saying.
Yes, I didn't see that in the transcripts. Perhaps if he can point me to a portion of the transcripts where that occurred, I can respond better, but I wasn't able to find that in the transcripts.
Okay, thank you.
So I'll move on to the next point, which is that the video of people arriving in red vehicles, which he calls his exonerating video. And I address this issue at paragraph 31 of my factum.
And there. Thank you.
So Mr. Potter argues that he had this exonerating video that would have showed that he was being harassed by people in red vehicles. And I think the transcripts show that he just trying to find the exact portion of the transcript if I have an indulgence. Yes, so paragraph 34 of my factum, I reference transcripts of proceedings from April 28th. And at that point, Mr. Potter tells Justice Boxall that he has several statements from various different officers refuting the charge. So based on that, he found that it wasn't necessary to play his video. And based on that interaction, along with the other interactions that I highlight throughout this portion of my factum, I would submit that this was clearly a tactical decision made by Mr. Potter at the time of trial to choose not to play his video. He explained that he thought that there was sufficient viva voce evidence from the officer witnesses that would substantiate his position that the elements of the offense were not made out. So the fact that now Mr. Potter wishes he did differently or wishes he did not make that tactical decision is not a basis to allow the appeal in my submission. I also note that at paragraph 36 of my factum, Mr. Potter refers to this video as fresh evidence for the purpose of his appeal. I would respectfully disagree with that assessment. The video and the circumstances do not meet the Palmer criteria for admission, and I would submit that there's no basis upon which that ground of appeal should succeed. I think it's also important to note that this Mr. Palmer did play some videos throughout his trial, so I think this further demonstrates his tactical decisions of which videos he wanted to play and which ones he didn't want to play. And it also occurred at a time when he was assisted by 486 counsel, which is also an important consideration. So I'll move on to my third point, which is the psychiatric.
Excuse me, before you do, Madam Crown, just to pick up on your last point, are you saying that the decision with respect to whether to play the video Mr. Potter is now saying he would like to rely on was made at the time when Mr. Potter had the assistance of 486 counsel? Was it in the context of a cross-examination?
Yeah, so I cite that from the appellant's factum, page 12, paragraph 54. So I'm just going to go back to that. So paragraph 54 and 55 of the appellant's factum, he writes, the exonerating video was not played and the appellant did not further pursue presenting the video as evidence because of the overwhelming amount of exculpatory evidence given by the witnesses. He believed the elements of the offense were not proven. The self-represented appellant was unclear on whether the video could be submitted into evidence after Ms. Vanderbilt had testified due to some legal precedent advised by Mr. Del Greco. Mr. Del Greco was the 46th counsel. So what I take from that submission is that he had some type of conversation with Mr. Del Greco, and then based on what he says in paragraph 54, that he chose not to present it because he thought he had sufficient exculpatory evidence from the witnesses. So that's my submission for saying that it was a tactical decision made at a time when he was provided with advice from 46th counsel. And then throughout those paragraphs in my factum, paras 31 to 36, I highlight other portions where Justice Boxall explained how to admit videos into evidence, and Mr. Potter made it very clear that it wasn't his intention to do so. So I think he had ample opportunity and ample explanation at the time, and his choice not to was a tactical trial decision.
Justice Boxall said he would have to hop up on the witness stand in order to rely on the video.
Yes, and he said he did not want to do that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so moving on to my third point, which is the psychological restraint. I addressed that at beginning at paragraph 37 of my factum. And towards the end of that copy and paste of the transcript, there's an interaction where Justice Boxall asks the witness, I think the question is, he's not physically restraining you. And she answers, he was not physically restraining me. No, you're correct. And Justice Boxall says, you felt psychologically. And she says, yes, that's right. And Mr. Del Greco says, right. And so I understand how Mr. Potter can perceive this as leading the witness. But I think if we just read it in that one context, perhaps Mr. Potter would have a point, but I think we need to take it into the broader context of the trial in generally. Ms. Vanderbilt had already testified all of the reasons why she didn't leave her vehicle, the reasons that she was afraid. She felt that if she did get out on foot, she would be physically attacked, how she couldn't leave with her vehicle because his van was blocking her in, how she was on the phone with a staffer contemplating 911 until they eventually did call 911. So I think all of this evidence is a basis for Justice Boxall to make that suggestion to her. I would submit that he wasn't leading her, he was just giving a name to what she had described in her evidence. And I think the fact that 46 counsel agrees and says right demonstrates that there was this already existing evidentiary basis for Justice Boxall to make that inference that she was psychologically confined. Mr. Potter says in his submissions today that Justice Boxall was the only one who ever said psychological confinement. I would dispute that. The Crown at the trial expressly made some submissions about psychological detention at the conclusion of the trial and how it was made out. So I think there was definitely a sufficient evidentiary basis for the trial judge to make that inference. And even if it was a leading question, it would be a matter of weight and not admissibility of the evidence. I think her evidence should be taken contextually and in its totality. So subject to any questions on that point, I'll move on to my next one.
I do have a question. The Crown's reference to psychological restraint, was that after Justice Boxall had made his comment, or was that in opening statement?
That was in submissions, but I can do another browse through the transcripts to see if it was referenced again. Yes, I think the Crown's reference to psychological detention was made at submission, so it would have been after that. But again, I would assert that the psychological detention was obvious based on Ms. Vanderbilt's testimony as a whole. And there's no requirement that she uses the express word psychological detention or psychological confinement in order for the court to understand what she means. A lot of times these lay witnesses don't know the legalities or the legalese that we refer to. So I think the court was entitled to draw that inference based on the totality of her evidence.
Thank you.
So I'll move on to the arguments made about former Chief of Police Peter Slowly, and I address those starting at paragraph 26 of my factum. So Mr. Potter says today that Mr. Slowly was issued a lawful subpoena and that he intentionally disobeyed that subpoena. I would say that there was no ruling on this issue at the initial trial. Justice Boxall made clear that he wasn't ruling on the lawfulness of the subpoena, whether it was lawfully issued or whether it was properly served. Rather, he was only ruling on whether an adjournment should be granted to allow some remedy to get him to court to testify. So based on that issue, Justice Boxall heard submissions from both Mr. Potter and the Crown about whether Mr. Slowly had any relevant and material evidence to provide. Mr. Potter's submissions on that issue, I would submit, were very similar to his submissions today on this appeal. And based on that, the trial judge found that there was no material or relevance to have Mr. Slowly attend to the trial. And I would submit that based on what we heard today, that continues to be the case. It still remains unclear to me as to how Mr. Slowly could have had any relevant bearing at the trial. I think anything that he would have said would have been a collateral issue. The submissions we heard today about MP McKenna's podcast, again, I would submit that's a collateral issue as well. And there's simply just no relevance to the issues before the trial judge at the time of the trial, and his ultimate decision that there was no reasonable possibility that Chief Slowly's evidence could be of any assistance to him was well founded based on the issues before the court and the submissions of both parties at the time. So unless Your Honor has any questions, I'll move on to the next point.
No, you may move on, Ms. Fahim.
Thank you. So Mr. Potter today was taking issue with how these criminal offenses came about. He says that the 911 call taker originally labeled this as a criminal harassment or suspicious person occurrence, but it ultimately resulted in an unlawful confinement charge. And he asked Your Honor to speculate on how that came about. I think the most obvious inference here is that the complainant provided a statement to police, and police analyzed that evidence and found reasonable and probable grounds to lay that charge. I admit that's not unusual or uncommon. Police are entitled to lay criminal charges as the evidence unfolds before them. And It's similar to just like a hypothetical. If 911 are called for one purpose and police attend the scene and result that there's a different situation going on, that doesn't preclude them from responding to what they see once they observe on the scene. So I would submit that that's not an unusual or uncommon occurrence, and I don't see any issue with that.
So complainants aren't expected to be familiar with the elements of criminal offenses?
Yes. And I think it's also important to note that it was the 911 call taker who described this as a criminal harassment and suspicious person, based on what she was hearing from the complainant. You know, just like as a hypothetical, if the police were to attend to a residence for a heart attack, but then they see evidence of a crime, that doesn't stop them from pursuing the criminal offense just because they were called for the purposes of a medical emergency. Like, they're allowed to respond as things transpire, as the case before them unfolds, as they receive and evidence and form their reasonable and probable grounds, and that's precisely what happened here. Mr. Potter says that he should not be convicted, or the conviction was unlawful because there was no element of fear for the unlawful confinement. I would dispute that assertion. I think it was very clear from Ms. Vanderveld's testimony that she was fearful, and I quoted some of her testimony in the facts portion of my factum. So, beginning at paragraph 7, I quote some transcripts of proceedings from April 27, where she says that she was unnerved and getting scared, and how she debated calling 911. And then at paragraph 28, I highlight the quotes where she says that she became terrified and told her staff member to indeed call 911. And at paragraph 29, how she said the reasons why she didn't escape from her vehicle by foot was because she was afraid that Mr. Potter could have overpowered her physically. And then at paragraph 12, where I quote that she stated that the whole experience generally caused her to be terrified, fearing for her life, and very, very scared. So I think there was indeed an evidentiary basis to find that she was fearful. And Mr. Potter goes on to say that there was no element of force for the unlawful confinement. And I addressed that issue at paragraph 49 of my factum. I think Mr. Potter is incorrect in law when he says that force or threat of force is a requirement for unlawful confinement. The Supreme Court of Canada made very clear in the case of Richard, and the citation is 2008, Supreme Court of Canada 59, at paragraph 25, that the criminal code reference to forcible confinement is only there for ease of reference, and it's not an operative part of the offense. The court says, quote, the adverb forcibly, as it appears in section 279 sub 2, adds nothing to the elements of the offense. It simply qualifies the verb seizes. And I think that's why we generally have moved on from saying forcible confinement to unlawful confinement, because forcible confinement paints this picture that it has the elements of force that needs to be there, and the Supreme Court made clear that that's not the case. Mr. Potter said today that Ms. Vanderbilt testified that she was able to leave the first and only time she attempted to leave, and that demonstrates that she was not forcibly confined. I would disagree with that assertion. She testified that she could not leave with the car because of his van was blocking her in, and she could not, she believed she could not leave on foot because he could have overpowered her. And that belief that she could not leave on foot goes against the psychological restraint element. And she testified the first opportunity that she had to leave by vehicle was the first opportunity that she took. So once Mr. Potter left with his van, she took that opportunity to escape her Prius, even though the 911 call taker was telling her, stay put, the police are on their way. She said that she was so afraid that she took that that opportunity to flee. And it's important to note that Justice Boxall, when he was calculating the amount of time that Ms. Vanderbilt was confined, he said from the time that Mr. Potter pulled up to the van until that first opportunity to leave, anything after that was not factored into the timeline. I would respectfully submit, Your Honor, that Mr. Potter makes a couple of bald assertions today that don't have any evidentiary basis to substantiate his position. So, for example, when he says the elements of the offense of unlawful confinement were missing, or the trial judge applied uneven scrutiny, there's no explanation or evidentiary basis given to substantiate these arguments. And so it becomes a little bit difficult for me to respond because he doesn't provide a reason for saying so. He just makes these bald assertions. So in my respectful submission, there's just simply no evidence that the trial judge applied uneven scrutiny to the evidence before him or that he applied the wrong legal test. And I address that issue at paragraph 48 and following of my factum. All in all, I would just submit that there's been Mr. Potter did not meet his onus of demonstrating that there was any error of law, and that any findings of fact were entitled to substantial deference on this appeal, and there's no palpable or overriding error that should displace that deference. So subject to any questions, Your Honor, those are my submissions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Fagan. I have no further questions. Mr. Potter.
Yes, Your
Mr.
Honor.
Mr. Potter, I give you an opportunity to reply. Now, I gave Madam Crown the morning break in order to prepare or to streamline her submissions. Would you like a 15-minute break before you make your reply submissions, or are you ready to go now?
I think I'm ready to go now.
Okay, whenever you're ready.
Okay, Your Honor. So the Crown mentions the calculation of Ms. Vanderbilt's time in her testimony. So initially she testifies to 10 to 15 minutes. The judge decides it's come down to 7 or 8 minutes. But when it's calculated, when each of the each of Ms. Vanderbilt's testimony is calculated, she testifies to 4 to 4.5 minutes. Furthermore, at Appeal Book page 56, paragraph 5, she testifies that in between 1 to 3 minutes of the incident, she tells her staffer that she's okay. So at that point, she's technically not forcibly confined by her description. So, with the 4 to 4.5 minutes minus the 1 to 3 minutes, we're looking at a minute to a minute and a half. And so a judgment's been made on in excess of 5 minutes.
Mr. Potter, I'm going to ask you to run that by me again. And but before you do, I'm going to find that reference in the appeal book so that I know exactly what you're referring to.
Yes, Your Honor. So I guess it's starting at appeal book page 54, paragraph 25. Ms. Vandenbalt testifies that she was confined for 10 to 15 minutes.
Okay, so I'm on, I think you have me looking at a portion of Ms. Vandenbalt's transcript, is that right?
Yes, on page 54 of the appeal, of my appeal book.
On
at paragraph 25, she testifies that she was confined for 10 to 15 minutes.
Okay, I see that around line 27. She says, I'd say about 10 to 15 minutes, but at least 10 minutes. Okay?
Yes, Your Honor. And then, so when the tally is taken from her testimony, she testifies and accounts for 4 to 4.5 minutes in total at various spots throughout her testimony. And then on appeal book page 56, paragraph 5, she testifies that, I guess it would be on, I guess, line 8, she testifies that she asked her staffer asked her if she wanted her to call somebody, and she said she was okay. And so she's testifying that she's okay between 1 to 3 minutes of the incident. So now we're looking, now we're discussing a minute and a half, which the video evidence, I guess, we can get to that. So my friend is saying that I chose not to play the video tape. So that's incorrect. I, as you noted, Your Honor, I did not want to take the witness stand without proper legal advice. So that section seems to have been omitted, where I was quite willing and quite prepared to present this, because I felt that at that point of the trial, when the judge was asking me, I felt that there was a possibility that he thought that in spite of all of Ms. Vandenbalt's perjury, that there was still a possibility that they felt that I committed some sort of crime here. And so I stated I would not take the witness stand without proper legal advice. So by that time I had no legal counsel, and I wanted to have legal advice before I put myself on a witness stand. My friend states that the witness doesn't know legalese. I'm not sure the word psychological is legalese. Psychological confinement is legalese. I think that's, Ms. Vandenbalt is a liberal MP, quite a worldly woman. I'm quite sure she knows what psychological is, or what that word, how to utilize that word. In reference to my friend talks about how the police officers will make a determination on what crime to charge a person with as the case evolves, or as the investigation evolves. But we can see that. We can see that Ms. Vandenbalt was saying she was harassed. The 911 caller was saying she was harassed. She stated to the attending officer that she was harassed. And the police themselves, Detective Donaghy, in communicating weeks later with internal communications and their internal emails, were communicating that he was investigating a harassment and suspicious person case. So 2 weeks later, after the matter. So the forcible confinement definitely appears to be a fabricated or formulated plan here, I guess. So the
Mr. Potter, what do you I just have a question, Mr. Potter. You're saying that the forcible lawful confinement charge appears to be fabricated. When you say formalized, or what do you mean by that? Formulated, I think was the word you used. What does that mean?
Well, Your Honor, the record shows that I've been making criminal complaints to the OPS, the Ottawa Police Service, about red vehicles driving by my house simultaneously to me leaving and arriving and at work since 2018. So this has been going on for by the time this incident occurs at Ms. Vanderbilt, it's been going on for well over 2 years. This is the third criminal complaint, three criminal complaints. And in fact, when I look at... When I'm referring to the judge's uneven standard of scrutiny, I'm referring to that where the judge is saying, hey, all your complaints from 2018, 2019, 2020 about red vehicles harassing you at your places of work and home, arriving simultaneous to you at exactly the same time. So as I say in my factum, I'm an electronic security expert. I know how GPS tracking things work, and I know what group apps are, and I've designed and developed a lot of this electronics myself for the 2010 Olympics. So I'm aware of how this technology functions. So I've made these complaints, Your Honor. The trial judge was not looking at that. Was not applying the even standard of my complaint, but it was just taking whatever she said as at face value without that. And so the uneven standard of scrutiny. It should also be noted that I. At the time of this arrest, I had the
stop you, Mr. Potter. Yes. My question was just what you meant by the word formulated. That was all. You said that the forcible confinement charge appeared to be fabricated or formulated.
Yes.
And I wanted to know what you meant by formulated. Just if you could just help me with your definition of that word, and then I'll let you continue.
Yes, there was no charge at the beginning. There was no thought of that. And that in a backroom deal, probably with Peter Slowly or someone in the Liberal Party, some friend of the Liberals, decided that, hey, how can we create this situation where we can charge this person for this? So this is when I'm referring to mid-level violence, where state crimes are committed against an individual, and then they basically charge the individual for reacting to those crimes. And so this is a...
So I think you're saying that formulated and fabricated are essentially synonymous in your submission. Is that fair?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, that's fine. Yes, Your Honor, because
we have Ms. Vandenbeld stating to the 911 caller that she's being harassed. Not confined. We have the attending officer saying that Ms. Vandenbeld told him she was being harassed, not confined. We have the Ottawa police communicating with each other in internal emails 2 weeks after the incident, saying that they're investigating a harassment, not a forcible confinement. So somewhere along the way there, after the fact, and my friend said, well, if the evidence shows that a forcible confinement charge would apply here, then it would apply, and the police have the right to do so. And I agree with that. However, we're seeing that the complainant, the attending officer, the 911 call taker, and the detective in the matter are investigating a harassment case all the way up to 2 or 3 weeks after the incident. So the forcible confinement definitely appears to be a fabricated or formulated to see what they could derive from this incident. So the uneven standard of scrutiny, it is on record that I did make, an officer did testify that I made 3 criminal complaints from 2018 about red vehicles arriving at my house or job at the simultaneous to me arriving at my home and job. And so Ms. Vandenbouw, this is what Ms. Vandenbouw was doing in her red Toyota Prius. So the uneven standard of scrutiny applied when none of that was looked at from the trial judge. So the I also had, and it is listed in the very beginning, I guess is point number one in my factum, that during this time I had the Ottawa police in Superior Court trying to resolve a matter of them not investigating my criminal complaints about red vehicles harassing me at my place of home and work and elsewhere throughout the city at various GPS waypoints. So we have an OIPRD Superior Court application being made about these red vehicles. We have 3 criminal complaints made about these red vehicles. We have the complainant, the attending officer, and the detective saying they're investigating a harassment. So we're seeing all this thing straight across here that it definitely looks like something other than law enforcement was going on here. So, Your Honor, the justice or the judge, the trial judge, didn't give you know, enough scrutiny to that. So all of those cases, all of that, those incidents combined, I guess, kind of to me point to I guess would be a miscarriage of justice in that the judge made legal errors and accepted a lot of Ms. Vandenbouw's testimony in spite of the fact that she perjured herself. And in spite of the fact that it was being investigated as a harassment complaint initially and for weeks after, and the video in question that I did want to present shows that in fact Ms. Vandenbouw has perjured herself. That the video shows me observing her from a great distance with a zoom lens and then pulling up behind her, getting out of the vehicle, filming her for 4 seconds, getting back in my vehicle and turning around. And so that to me is exonerating evidence, and I respectfully submit that it should be allowed or should be brought in front of this court to help make a determination on the witness testimony. And so that's my reply, Your Honor.
Mr. Potter, thank you very much, Ms. Fahim. I'm going to reserve my decision. I will not be releasing a decision today. I will be releasing a decision in writing as soon as I can. I thank you for your written materials and for your submissions today, Mr. Potter and Ms. Fahim. Thank you, Madam Registrar.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
Question.